This is Phil Farron, and I am driving around for a while and eventually going home. I've got, I need to run sound at rehearsal this evening. I am leaving work a little bit early because I had breakfast with a buddy this morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, and so I was actually at work at 7. So it's 3:30, so I'm taking off a little early. I gotta go see my dad. Gotta go find some supper at the Walmart. They have these prepackaged salads now that I kind of like, because they have like shredded Brussels sprouts in them and kale. And pretty good salad. So gonna go do that. But I thought, as long as I have a few minutes here and I'm going over to see my dad, I'll just do the podcast now. And, you know, then things can move out from here. Anyway, it's been a good week at work. We've got a lot of good things done this week. And we're ramping up to do some deploys coming up in November. So it looks like we're all on target for that. We've got people testing stuff. Lots of things going on. But I'm checking things off my list. My task list, and we're working through it. So it's good. One of my buddies just had a little baby, so it's fun. Young couple, it's fun to see his reactions to all this stuff. It's good, you know. Life goes forward. The ancient pageants keep playing out, and the species survives. So that's all very interesting. I'm just puttering along. I've got 2 full weeks on writing the next book, and that seems to be going along fine. I think I am right on track. I'm right on track this week for 10,000 words this week, so that's all going well. I am going to have a few little interruptions this evening, but that's the other reason to leave a little early, because I can head back then and get to church, and I only have 500 words to do this evening, and 500 words is pretty straightforward, so that's not, shouldn't be too bad. So if I can steal an hour before the rehearsal starts up at church, I will be good. I will be good. What else? I think that's it. Well, I have several topics that are stacking up in the queue of things that I'd like to talk about, because there is a great and many things moving around in the world. But I came across a TED Talk and I almost didn't click on it, but then I started listening to it. And at one point when I was listening to this, I bust out laughing because I thought, what? What? So I thought, well, let's just do this week, and then we'll see how everything continues to settle in, because there's lots of interesting things going on in the world. But this is pretty interesting. So I was watching 2 different TED Talks, and then there was actually a 3rd TED Talk that I was watching as well, and this guy was talking about the need for species when they can actually perceive better, then they start planning into the future, and then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And his idea was that brain development was based on need, and once the sensors that you have can extend farther, then you need bigger brains to try to figure out what possible futures might be. And, you know, it's all very interesting. It's just all very interesting. But specifically, the things that I'd like to chat about today comes down to this idea of interfacing brains directly to machines. So there was actually 2 TED Talks. One was called New Brain-Computer Interface Technology by Steve Hoffman. And the other was called Rethinking the Brain-Machine Interface by Polina Anikeeva, A-N-I-K-E-E-V-A. This was pretty interesting. This Steve Hoffman is part of Founderspace. It's a VC, venture capital, and accelerator thing. And I think he said that they were voted the number one VC accelerator firm that is investigating projects and doing projects overseas. So he was talking about the fact that he has traveled all over the world looking at projects, looking at current research. And so this was his TED Talk to say, this is where we are in terms of the current research that is being done in the brain-computer interface. And he said they're moving forward building brain interface chips, like sticking things in your brain, which is pretty exciting. He said at one point it was a little overstated. He said, you know, because now the computer can tell what you're dreaming. And I'm like, what? What? As it turns out, what it is like an EEG chip, and then you dream, and then you tell the computer, goes ahead and records all the EEG activity, and then you wake up and you tell the researchers what was happening in your dream, and then the next time you dream that, the computer can then compare the patterns and says, oh, I think you're dreaming that again. But it's not like the computer could just slap this on anybody and the computer can just watch a completely new person and said, oh, I think you're dreaming this. So we definitely are not there. But, you know, there are some pretty interesting things that I have questions about. Like he said that they had a monkey that had broken its back, and they put a chip in up like its neck, and then they put a transmitter, and then another chip down in its lower back beyond where the back was broken. And the transmitter transmits to the receiver, and he said, as soon as they did that, the monkey could walk again. Okay, well, that's pretty interesting. And pretty cool. I don't know if the computer there is actually doing anything in terms of real-time translation of understanding what it's doing, but if it is simply picking up neural activity in the spinal column and then just transferring it down, I can see how that might work. It would be interesting. He made it sound like they just hooked it up and all of a sudden the monkey was walking fine. But I don't... You would think there would have to be some relearning, because how would they get everything matched up exactly as far as the neurons firing? I don't know. That was pretty interesting. He said they have been able to, for instance, put a chip in a monkey's brain and put the monkey in a wheelchair and have the monkey drive the wheelchair around just by thinking about it. That's pretty interesting. He also said that researchers now have been able to put a chip in a monkey's brain and have the monkey feed itself just by thinking. Presumably, there's some training involved in that as well. But that's pretty interesting. The one that I just bust out laughing on, and I still don't know how this is... Anyways, he says that they put some chips in a rat's brain, and they taught the rat how to do like a complex sequence of events to get food. He said it took weeks to train these rats how to get food. And then he said they put another chip in another rat's brain that was in another city. And they connected the two wirelessly. Well, they connected the two through the internet. And they said that the rat in the other city immediately knew how to get food using the same complex patterns of activity. Now, this is what I bust out laughing. I mean, if there is any wonder in that, if there is any awe, if that actually happened, I would tend to put my wonder and awe, invest that in the human brain. Because I have a hard time believing that all the software and the hardware exists at this point that can actually decipher the brain enough that it can then be translated as a series of instructions over to another chip, and then that chip deciphers that series of instructions and actually figures out what neurons to stimulate to help the rat do something. I don't think they're there that yet. But, you know, if there's... I don't know how that would work, that the rat would learn. But this guy claims it happened. That the rat could learn how to get food. I don't know, it's interesting. It's interesting. But, anyways, obviously they are working on it. And so, from that, he said, since there's been this demonstration of transferring knowledge, like from one brain to another, then he began to extrapolate off of that. And some of these extrapolations are a bit far-fetched, but if we've seen anything in the last few years, is that the rate of progress is accelerating on all of these fronts. And it's very, very interesting. So if you could do that with the rat's brain, and you theoretically could get more and more sophisticated doing that type of thing, you could theoretically do mind-to-mind communication. And you could theoretically wire your brain up to the internet. And you could theoretically transfer memories. So if a person had a memory of skydiving, you could just download that memory. Or you could download knowledge. And you could do like a VR in your head. Now, again, this is going to take some pretty sophisticated mapping, but maybe the brain figures out. Maybe you can just give it a jumble of information and the brain figures it out. The trouble here, well, he also talked about living outside your body and the potential then you could experience other lives, other people's lives, and live through them. So, you know, whereas now people are having Twitter followers, that in fact at some point in the future, people could subscribe to your life feed and you could just lay there and experiencing everything they are experiencing. And, you know, I can just imagine that if someone was doing that and you had someone like a Miley Cyrus or a Kim Kardashian or something like that, that they would just allow you to subscribe to their live feed for 8 hours or so a day, and you'd do that. And the reason I say 8 hours or so a day is because all of these people who have a certain public persona that they are putting out there, the fact is when the shades go down and things go quiet, that their lives and their mental processes are far different than the public persona that they project. And so they would need some time off. And then, of course, there's like a sci-fi story buried down in all of that about someone who everyone was living their lives vicariously through because they were the most interesting man in the world, or because they were the princess. You know, Princess Kate, I'm sure, would get lots and lots of people subscribing to her feed. What does it look like? What does it feel like to be the princess? And I could see that happening, but I could also see it happening that people would only want to do that for a certain amount of time during the day. And of course, if you can do all of that, then you can create your own realities. And theoretically, if you learned enough about what those patterns were when things were being created, then you could simulate those patterns. You could make whatever kind of world you wanted. You could make a world where you could fly. You'd be super strong, etc., 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 etc. So, yeah, there's some interesting things on the horizon. And then, of course, if there's all of that, then you have to account for hacking. Or you have to account for someone else taking control of your body. And it's interesting because when he got to the end of his talk, he was talking about the fact that this could all be heaven or this could be hell. And knowing what I know of human nature, if there isn't some sort of throttle on this thing, if there isn't some sort of restrainer, this could turn out bad. And I don't think it's too hard to imagine all the ways that this could go bad. Which, you know, there is, it's interesting because there is, we talked about the Fermi paradox a couple of weeks ago, last week sometime, anyways, I can't remember. And the Fermi paradox is that, okay, if there's so many worlds out there and if there's such a vast universe out there, why haven't we found any other intelligent life? And one theory is that there is some vast filter that extinguishes advanced civilizations. And, you know, this particular thing of the computer-brain interface just might, from a purely secular viewpoint, humanistic viewpoint, I could see how this type of thing might be the thing that would be the filter. Because it would be very easy for me to believe that something like this would get away from cultures and civilizations. It wouldn't be hard to write this story at all. And who knows, it may show up in the Windfall series. The other talk that was part of this was by Polina Anikiva, Rethinking the Brain-Machine Interface. And she had some interesting things to say. She was talking about the state of the art and those types of things. She was talking about the fact that transistors right now are like 1/5,000th the width of a human hair, and that a neuron is only about 1/5 of the width of the human hair, and transistors run so much faster than the neuron does, so why wouldn't it be any problem to just hook them up? And she was talking about the fact the problem is that the interface that we use now is too hard, it's too immobile. And so there, and, you know, you have to drill holes in people's skulls. And, like, they do this deep something for Parkinson's, where they put drill holes in the skulls and they put probes down. And she was comparing how big these probes are according when compared to the neurons. And they are really huge compared to neurons. And so she said, and we apply voltages, then deep stimulation probes, I think is what they're called. Anyways, they apply voltages that are far beyond anything the neuron is doing. And she said, you do get some beneficial results when you kind of move them around and figure the right spot. But at the same time, strange things happen, like you can stimulate personality change and turn someone into an unstoppable gambler or give them an incurable depression. And she said that deep brain stimulation does cause that stuff. Now, there are side effects. She said the thing about the brain, and this was, I hadn't ever heard anyone say this, but then I thought, well, that sounds familiar. But anyways, she said, is it really is soft and pliable? She said, in fact, you can scoop it out with a spoon and it's the consistency of soft pudding. Oh, I don't think I want anybody scooping my brain out with no spoon, but what they eventually had developed was they've developed this probe that's the size of a human hair, and they can slip it in, and using this same probe, they can actually energize stuff with lasers, or they can inject chemicals in it to stimulate it or use electricity. And so she and her team are thinking that gently they can slip these probes in and the brain will treat them like another blood vessel or something like that, and that's fine. She said they're also experimenting with going completely wireless in terms of stimulating neurons. Read that in the far-flung future if you're smart enough and you know how. You could implant memories. You could cause the brain to be controlled remotely. So, but what they do is they inject a liquid that has magnetic nanoparticles in it, and they inject that into the brain, and then they use magnetic fields to stimulate those particles, cause heat, and then in the process of causing that heat, the neurons fire. So there are lots of interesting things that people are pursuing, and of course, it's all just a big academic exercise at this point until Skynet takes over and starts trying to control our brains. It is going to be a fascinating 10, 20 years here. The first guy, he really believed that there would be full implantable brain chips available to do all these things he's talking about within 10 years. So this is October of 2017. October 2027. I will be retired by then. The Lord tarries, devil don't hinder, and the crick don't rise. So it's going to be very interesting. Me personally, if it could decipher all the scratchings that are in my head when I'm writing, going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, you know, that would be pretty cool. If I could write faster if I could just think it and put it down. There is a certain control and a certain necessary throttling of the words that is required when I have to think to move my fingers, but that would be pretty cool. Just the question of whether I want people sticking things in the soft pudding of my head. And I'm just not sure about that one yet. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it around the block. And I'm going home later. Have a great week.